Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers from all around the world. We're so glad to have you here with us tonight on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Welcome. The solar wind is a respectable 483.5 kilometers per second, while the proton count is up to 2.4 protons per cubic centimeter. What does that mean? Well, not much of a sunburn out there today if you go out. There are two sunspots active and facing Earth today, 1073 and 1074, neither of which seem to pose a threat for flares. On May 29th, yesterday, the Interplanetary Magnetic Field, that's known as the IMF, tilted south and opened a crack in Earth's magnetosphere. Solar wind poured in and fueled a G1 class geomagnetic storm. Northern lights were sighted as far south as Wisconsin. The storm has subsided now. The next storm is due tomorrow, or June 1st, when a solar wind stream is expected to hit Earth's magnetic field. Also, just in case you'd like to know, asteroid 2010 JN71 passed within 8.2 lunar distances of Earth on the 26th. It's 245 meters in diameter. That was close. Looking over the next 4 days, the X-37B, the Air Force's mysterious robotic space shuttle, is passing over the eastern seaboard during the evening hours, but it will be faint, only about as bright as the small stars of the Dipper. But it will pass over twice a night, except for the 31st of May, tomorrow. It will pass over three times in a single night. You might want to jump out there and see if you can snap a few pictures of it if you have a really strong telephoto lens. There were 22 earthquakes greater than 3.0 on the scale worldwide, but none over 5.0. They're everywhere and very weak right now. Also, the U.S. Air Force on my birthday, by the way, thank you very much for all the Facebook wishes for a happy birthday. I got them all. I appreciated every single one of them. Thank you so much. Anyway, on May 27th, the Air Force successfully launched the first of a new generation of GPS satellites aboard a Delta IV rocket from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Boeing is under contract to deliver 12 GPS 2F satellites to the Air Force, and the program is more than 3 years behind schedule. A May 2009 report from a government watchdog agency said the program has incurred $870 million in cost growth since its inception. We call those cost overruns. According to Boeing spokesman Diana Ball, however, the program cost growth was due in part to changes in scope requested by the government. Boeing in 2008 lost out to Lockheed Martin Space Systems, also known as Skunk Works, in the competition to build the next generation GPS-3 satellites. The GPS-3 constellation is expected to begin launching in 2014. By the way, those satellites will only be used by aircraft and mostly military functions. So if you're having problems with your TomTom or your Garmin, it's probably because of the aging GPS satellites. Also, don't forget, Remembering the Future, the new ebook, is out right now. The printed version will take a little more than 45 days. We made a second round through editing this week. It's looking really good. But you can read it now and get a 25% discount on the printed version by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com. The ebook's only $7.95. A lot of people are holding out for the printed version, but you know, the ebook has some advantages because you get all those illustrations in color. Also, don't forget Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. I add stuff usually during the day as we approach the announcement on the Inner Earth Expedition, the launch of the nation's first affordable electric vehicles, and other great things. So follow me on Twitter by searching for Brooks Agnew. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. It's a short 30-minute program. The more you click and the more friends you send there, the better our chances of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word. We need something positive out there. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio will be right with you. Speaking of space travel, NASA confirmed this week that the Phoenix Mars lander is dead. Earlier this month, an image taken by another spacecraft, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, showed changes in Phoenix's shadows, consistent with predictions that hundreds of pounds of carbon dioxide ice accumulated on the spacecraft, bending or breaking its solar panels. Keep in mind, people, that that report that it doesn't get that cold on Mars, as people might think, should note that carbon dioxide freezes at minus 78 degrees Celsius. The good news is that with that much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's highly likely that photosynthesis can take place somewhere on Mars during the summer months. Maybe we need to send a little Edelweiss to Mars. The Dow had the worst May since 1940. Oil erased any gains the market tried to make. Obama is suspending exploration in two areas off Alaska, canceling pending lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico and proposed sales off Virginia's coast, extending by 6 months a moratorium on deep water drilling permits, and suspending operations at all 33 exploratory wells being drilled in the Gulf. This will further drive the cost of oil up and the value of stocks down. Without an alternative to oil as a fuel for transportation, retail businesses will suffer nationally. People will stay home. The cost of goods sold will increase. Jobs will be lost. Another energy industry must come forward to replace the shortage if we are to grow. What do I mean by that? Well, let's see. You know, at one time, many of you are too young to remember this, but at one time, alcohol was the fuel for cars. That's how the internal combustion engine started. Then, with one sweep of the pen, alcohol was made illegal, and Rockefeller's oil company had a new market overnight. Ever since then, we have been burning gasoline to drive our cars. In the 1960s, gas was cheap in the U.S., because the U.S. and Germany drilled for oil everywhere on cheap leases, because countries were hungry. Then, in the early 1970s, the OPEC nations, those are the nations that produce petroleum, decided to nationalize the rigs and equipment, and we had 300% inflation on oil in 1 year. I can tell you, I drove a 1969 Roadrunner, 383, 440, 4-barrel, and it was fast. And I thought the world was going to end because gas went to 73 cents a gallon. But I kind of saw their point. They had, these countries had limited resources, and it was being stripped from them cheaply and leaving them in poverty while the American and British oil companies made billions. Now, we have a different problem. That is refining capacity. The process of turning oil into fuel is dirty, and no one wants it in their backyard. Add to that the fact that we have not built a new nuclear facility in 25 years, and we have a real challenge on our hands. But that challenge has not been met with innovation in other fuels and sources of energy until recently. I say that not to inflame the airwaves tonight, because I know many of you know of advanced technologies that are out there, ideas that are trying their damnedest to get out to the people, to let them know that they can go off-grid, that they can drive their cars on something else, that much more efficient vehicles are possible. In the 2003 Bibendium, cars were going over 90 miles per gallon. The winner did 99 miles per gallon, driving on a racetrack and competing against the world's challengers. Of course, higher mileage solutions are out there. Of course, alternative fuels can be made. But it gets tricky. Even when fuel production begins from these alternative sources, the oil companies lobby for laws and specifications that make the fuel non-competitive. That means it costs too much at the pump, and you won't buy it. For instance, biodiesel, which has a 300% return on energy investment, would be a viable fuel except for one thing. The methanol, or ethanol, it takes to make the esterification reaction take place must be recovered until there is only 0.2% left in the mixture. The natural distillation limit is 2%. That's 10 times higher. And it takes very little energy to reach. Just simple distillation will get it there. The rest of the methanol is chemically bonded and cannot evaporate at any temperature at atmospheric pressure. In fact, the fuel is higher quality and produces more power in this natural state. But the oil companies lobbied for tighter specifications, which require 90% more energy to be poured into the process to achieve. And that's why biodiesel costs more than regular diesel at the pump. Add to that the fact that methanol is produced by, you guessed it, the oil companies, and imported into the United States. There's no large-scale production of methanol in the United States. So by the time the methanol gets in the country, gets shipped to the plant, it's about $4.70 a gallon. Now, that is used in copious amounts in the reaction. Some of it is recovered, and it can be reused as long as it's blended with virgin methanol. But that raises the price of biodiesel to about a dollar above the price of diesel from petroleum. So the best we can hope for is biodiesel blended with regular diesel. Add to that that ethanol from cellulosic sources, not from corn, but from the corn stalks, the cobs, switchgrass, agricultural waste, has been tried for almost a century. Now, they can make it work, but the regulations are such that no one can afford to make it. The cost should be about 20 cents a gallon to produce from agricultural waste, but federal funding requires enzymatic processes to increase yields. It also makes the cost 10 times higher. Without the grant funding, no one can afford to start a facility and take the time to build the market. ethanol for gasoline is an energy waste of time. It barely produces one for one. Usually it's about 80% return on energy investment. By the time you plow the fields and process the waste, ship it to the plant and all of that, the ethanol added to gasoline just doesn't make the gasoline that much more powerful. In fact, it makes it less powerful. But for biodiesel, it can generate massive profits for natural, renewable, and clean-burning fuel that does not require any petroleum products. Methanol, of course, is made from natural gas and comes from the oil companies, usually from countries in South America. Now, one thing to pay attention to in South America is their winter is our summer. So naturally, in the winter time up here, it's summertime down there. Natural gas is not used very much for heating. So therefore, the methanol gets very expensive. In the summertime in the United States, it's winter in the South. So natural gas is in production. And methanol can be used, produced from that natural gas, and the price goes down. But this swing in pricing can be up to 50%. 50% swings in pricing on your raw materials to make the biodiesel means that you cannot predict the industry. It's very, very difficult to predict a profit in the biodiesel industry when your price of commodities, your raw materials, is swinging so wildly. This could be fixed. This could be stabilized and produce thousands of jobs in the United States if cellulosic ethanol would be funded and deregulated so that plants could get up and get running. Now, we have friends in the cause, my dear Earth Explorers. Recently, we have been really deluged with news about a spill in the Gulf of Mexico. BP's oil rig blew up, and we'll explain to you why that happened, how that happened. And we would invite your phone calls and your comments on it. The phone number tonight, if you want to be part of the program, is 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. Anywhere, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us. 415-762-1161. Now, what's going on is this is being billed as one of the greatest ecological disasters in the history of the United States. Young people can say that. People that are familiar with the oil industry know that in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, we were hungry for oil, and there were no such regulations. In Southern California, there was a gusher that got away that flowed 100,000 barrels of oil a day. It filled up a valley with oil, and they were rowing boats across the valley in a sea of oil. They attempted to pump it all into trucks and haul it away, but they only got about half of it before the gusher finally subsided and they were able to control the well. The rest of it seeped into the soil of the valley. Today, houses and freeways and businesses and even agricultural products are grown in that land, and you can't tell that 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, there were oil spills of a most horrible kind. I grew up in Huntington Beach. When our homes were built there, right across the street were deep oil wells packed side by side, open top tanks with black crude bubbling into them all day and all night. Spills all over the ground, tar, sticky and black, covered the fields across from our home. Sure enough, the Southern California real estate became too expensive. The oil wells weren't producing like they used to. So they removed the wells, bulldozed the sites, and built malls and schools and subdivisions. You can't even tell that those spills occurred years ago. But this is different. This is different. This spill is not taking place deep into the ocean, hundreds of miles off of our coast. Far from it. It's occurring a mere 50 miles off the coast of Louisiana. in the prime fishing area of the Gulf of Mexico. Recently, one of our friends, Leilani Munter, she's the race car driver. She's also a green monster in a little package. This month, she made a visit to the Gulf of Mexico to see for herself what is going on. This is what she said in her own words. After spending a week in Venice, Louisiana, getting an up-close view of the BP Gulf Coast oil spill disaster, talking with locals whose livelihoods are over, and seeing dead wildlife, I am trying my best to look at the positive side. Keep in mind that I just got off the phone with one of my boat captains in Louisiana, and he told me he saw 6 dead dolphins and 10 dead turtles in the past few days. So the idea of looking on the bright side is nearly impossible, and most days I fail. But I think it is human nature to try to find something positive in the face of a catastrophe. The only positive thing that can possibly come from this, the largest environmental disaster in American history, is if it causes us to change the way we are living on this earth. When Dale Earnhardt Sr. died on the last lap of the Daytona 500 in 2001, it devastated NASCAR. He was their biggest star and a hero to most of their audience. The one positive thing that came from his death is that racing took a good hard look at safety, and they made some really big changes. After his death, all drivers were required to wear full-face helmets. Earnhardt wore an open-face helmet, as well as a Hans device, that's a head and neck restraint system. Safer barriers or soft walls were installed in the speedways so that when we crashed, the racetrack wall would help absorb some of the impact. It cost millions of dollars, but it has also likely saved many lives. I have since had wrecks at nearly 200 miles per hour. One impact was so intense, it put a crack through my motor, and I have walked away with nothing but bruises and a sore back. I don't know for sure that I would have walked away from those crashes if many years earlier Earnhardt hadn't passed away and changed the safety rules of racing. His death marked a permanent change in the way motorsport safety was conducted. NASCAR drew a line in the sand and never looked back. That fateful moment made racing safer for all drivers that have strapped themselves into a race car since, including myself. Perhaps one day we will look back at this oil spill and think, if the Gulf Coast oil spill hadn't happened, we wouldn't have kick-started our clean energy economy back in 2010. We wouldn't have made such great strides with solar PV and thermal technology, geothermal energy, wind and tidal turbines, green buildings, hydrogen fuel cell, and electric cars, alternative fuels like cellulosic ethanol and algae-based biodiesel, and we might not have passed the American Power Act. Perhaps we will look back and incredulously say, imagine if the Gulf Coast oil spill hadn't happened. We might actually still be running our country on dirty fossil fuels and spending billions of dollars buying oil from foreign countries. Wouldn't that be awful? Charles Darwin once said, "It's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor is it the most intelligent that survives. It is the one that is most adaptable to change." And so our time has come. This is the 11th hour. We either change the way we are living on the planet or relegate ourselves to eventually having our planet covered with oily water, polluted air, dead coral reefs, and cattle pastures where there were once rainforests. I hope that this disaster will wake us up and make those in charge realize that now is the time for us to turn over a new leaf, to check ourselves into rehab, to get off our addiction to fossil fuels and start a new, sober life with clean, renewable energy. I am a race car driver. My career is currently based around an internal combustion engine, and yet even I can see the importance of energy independence and the move toward the use of clean, renewable energy. We are at a crossroads, and I hope we take the right turn, or maybe it's a left. Let's take a step, or even better, a leap in the right direction. Let's pass the American Power Act and start putting a real effort into capturing clean energy from the wind, the sun, and the ocean. Let's put Americans to work building our new green energy economy. We've been talking about it for years. The technology is already here. All we have to do now is to make it happen. What in the world are we waiting for? Millions of gallons of oil to spill into the Gulf of Mexico? My greatest hope in the wake of this ongoing tragedy is that this is our clean energy wake-up call. My biggest fear? That we won't answer the call. Those are the words of Leilani Munter. Now, I would also like to play for you a YouTube of her. This is her words as she speaks about her experience off the coast of Louisiana with the Gulf Coast oil spill. Pay close attention.
It's now been 1 month since the Deepwater Horizon sank, and oil is still gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. I spent a week getting an up-close view of the BP oil spill disaster and the damage it's doing to not only our environment and all of the wildlife in our oceans, but also the people of the Gulf Coast, who are only just now getting back on their feet from Hurricane Katrina.
What I'm doing for a living is fishing, and I make my money fishing. There's not a price that they could pay to fix this at all. I mean, you know, I've been doing this since I was a little kid. Now it's ruined. And there's, like I said, there's not a price that they can possibly pay to fix what they've done. There's no way. So.
After the Exxon Valdez oil spill, a settlement of $5 billion was awarded to the people whose livelihoods were ruined by the oil spill. Exxon fought this for 2 decades and got it reduced to just $500 million, pennies on the dollar, and by the time these legal wars were over, 20% of the fishermen who were supposed to be paid by Exxon were already dead. We cannot let this happen again.
Yeah, it could ruin us for a long time. They're saying if it does come in here, it could ruin us for about 15 years. So we have to find another career.
The images that you're looking at, I took 70 miles away from where the Deepwater Horizon sank. Charles Darwin once said, "It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent that survives. It is the one that is most adaptable to change." And so in the spirit of Charles Darwin, it is time for us to utilize our intelligence to change, to adapt the way that we are living on this planet.
It's going to completely devastate this area. When I say devastated, it's going to make Hurricane Katrina look like a drop in a bucket.
As a race car driver, my career is dependent on an internal combustion engine. And yet even I can see the importance of ending our addiction to fossil fuels and making the move towards the use of clean, renewable energy from the wind and the sun and the ocean. Use that renewable energy to make electricity for our cars, for our homes, and for our buildings. Our constant burning of fossil fuels, which currently puts 90 million tons of CO2 into our atmosphere every day, is destroying the balance of life on Earth. I want clean air and clean water for people and for all the species that live on Earth.
These people don't have a strong voice in Washington, D.C. And so when it comes to making policy over how these oil platforms are managed, the oil industry has the upper hand because they have lobbyists, they have lawyers, they have experts. The shrimpers, the oystermen, and the other fishermen don't have that kind of voice.
Big Oil currently spends $150 million a year on 750 full-time lobbyists that that work to get the laws written in their favor, and just look at what they've done to the Gulf of Mexico. We cannot allow big oil to continue to get away with these crimes against humanity, wildlife, and our ecosystems. Call and write your senators and tell them that you want clean energy for our planet and energy independence for America. Let's stop spending all of our money overseas buying oil from foreign countries and instead put Americans to work right here, building our green energy economy. Let's do this together. The time is now. Enough.
And I'm just a fisherman. They should have had a backup plan before they drilled. You can't kill Mother Nature with chemicals and expect to clean it up.
I'd like to take just a moment to send a message to BP CEO Tony Hayward. The company that you lead has caused the largest environmental disaster in American history, and it is going to take decades for our ecosystems and for our people to recover. I think I speak for all of the American people when I say that your cavalier and dismissive attitude towards this oil spill is not making you any friends. Maybe you should spend a little less time doing media interviews trying to reduce the perceived impact of your oil spill, and instead spend more time trying to plug the leak and cleaning up the mess that you have made in our Gulf.
There you have it, 200-mile-an-hour Leilani Munter delivering it to BP. And she speaks for me, too. So those of you that doubt that this is a disaster, you're listening to the PR, you don't realize that those full-time lobbyists in Washington are keeping biodiesel, cellulosic ethanol, wind generators, and even other renewable fuels off the market. They're keeping their monopoly on the internal combustion engine. Well, I can tell you that the people have had enough. And if X Squared Radio has any effect on getting you not only awakened, but also into action, to pick up your mouse pad, go to your computer, go to your congressman and your senator, and write them a letter. Write them a note, and if they don't answer you back, then you need to mark an X across them and find someone who will re-elect Congress, elect a new Congress, elect a new Senate. I'm telling you, there's only 435 of them up there, and we can do this. Now, there are some solutions that are being proposed. I'm going to play for you a possible solution in just a moment, but I want to make sure that you understand that I want you to answer the question, are you awake? Well, I believe you are. Now, the next question is, what can you do about it? Well, I'll tell you what you can do. And I don't think that the boycott BP efforts that are out there are going to work, because BP isn't alone. They're also not the largest oil company, and they're not the largest buyer of lobbyists in Washington. They're not the ones paying for the condos and the golf trips. They're not the ones that are contributing hundreds of millions of dollars to campaigns to elect officials that will vote legislation that protects their interests into office. You can start by buying an electric vehicle. Oops, that's right. There aren't any for sale. Well, that can be fixed this year. That's right. There are companies out there right now, just like Vision Motor Cars, and they are ready to deliver you the solution to all of this. Now, don't worry about this being an infomercial. That's not what this is. There's room for at least 15 major electric car manufacturers. I can't tell you all their names, but I can tell you who they are not. They are not General Motors. They are not Ford. They are not Chrysler, Nissan, nor Toyota. There is nothing in this for them, and they are scared to death. They are giants, like 10-mile-long oil tankers, and they cannot turn from their course. And their course is to make gasoline-powered cars and trucks. There is no gain for them to add electric cars to their lineup. Every car they make that's electric will replace another car they make. There's no win for them. Now, I was speaking with a government official the other day, and she asked me a very strange question. Do you think the Department of Energy feels confident in giving money to a startup, to a small business, to bring cars to the public? Or do you think they would be better off giving their money to the established car companies that have dealerships, maintenance stations, and networks to be able to service the vehicles that would be in the hands of the American people? And I answered her very quickly. I said, are we talking about the same companies that went bankrupt a few months ago that pulled $40 billion of tax money down a black hole to cover their mismanagement? Are we talking about the same companies who have been talking about electric vehicles since 1995 and still don't have an affordable vehicle for the American people? Are we talking about those companies? Are we talking about the companies that have regular layoffs and union squabbles on a daily basis? I think we are. And I said, I think absolutely the government would have a much better payoff on their investment if they put their money into small business. If they put it into companies that would actually hire new people, people that are out of work, and that those companies would be nimble, and they would be agile, and they would be able to respond to you, the American people. One of the things that people don't understand is that electric cars will last for 30 years or more. They have far fewer moving parts. There's no oil in them, no water, no belts, no hoses. They only have 6 or 7 moving parts, and electric motors with no brushes and no bearings will outlast the metal it takes to build them. I'm asking you to get them started. It's up to new companies, companies who know how to make electric vehicles. They can make an affordable vehicle that the average American can drive and charge up in their own garage with their own regular outlets. No multi-billion dollar charging grid is necessary. We have one. It's called an electrical outlet. If you haven't heard about these cars, that's because the companies cannot afford to reach you with fancy commercials. You will have to go to them. So invest if you have it. Donate if you can. And by all means, buy one of their vehicles. Start driving to work in an electric vehicle. And believe me when I tell you from my own experience, not buying gasoline is the sweetest feeling of freedom I have felt in years. What's more, my truck is fueled with 100% American-made electricity. And your electric car will be too. But we have some work to do. We have some house cleaning to do. And when I say house cleaning, I mean the House of Representatives and the Senate and the White House. We are tired of inaction and lies. We are tired of deception and bleeding the American people of taxes while doing nothing to help clean the energy industry. So, there are some solutions out there for this spill. This one was just recently dropped into my hands. I'm going to play it for you. Maybe it's a solution. I know many of you haven't heard about it because it hasn't been clicked on very much on YouTube. This is out there. Now I want you to listen.
I'm making this video to get the word out about a process that's guaranteed to clean up the oil spill before our animals end up like this picture. What they're doing now is using buoys and booms. It's like holding up a string trying to keep a hurricane from hitting your house. It's just not going to happen. The oil will go over it. The oil will go under it. The same thing with dispersants. Folks, wake up. Dispersants are toxic. They're just as toxic as the oil that we're trying to hide. It's like putting paint thinner on a glob of wet paint. It just thins it out. It doesn't get rid of anything. We're allowing BP to just hide how big the problem is by turning it into a thin sheen. There's only one solution that can stop total disaster, and it's been proven several times on real oil spills to work. And I have physically talked to several of the companies that provide this particular solution, and they are sitting there saying they have warehouses full of product. It's microbes. Microbes physically eat the oil in just days, leaving the water clean and safe for wildlife. And when the microbes get finished with the oil, it dies and it's completely harmless. I'm looking for folks that will actually help me get the word out to the press, to BP, and either the federal or state governments down there. Watch this video, and my contact information is at the end. Get in touch with me, and I will talk to anybody that will listen, and we'll get this mess cleaned up in 6 weeks, not 5 or 6 years.
So there you have it. I mean, the solution is out there, okay? These technologies are available that are ecologically safe, and they can work. Now, why is BP not using this kind of technology? Why are they not taking matters into their own hands like a responsible company and taking care of this mess? We don't really know. But I'd love to hear from you, your ideas, 415-762-1161. Anywhere, on planet or off planet, if you've got a feeling about what's going on down there in the Gulf of Mexico, and believe me, this is quite typical. It's just that these spills normally take place deep out at sea, so we don't really see the impact on our local ecologies like we are in Louisiana. The number, 415-762-1161. How about calling in? Let me know how you feel and what actions your community is taking to let your congressman know that these kinds of solutions are out there. By the way, if you want the contact information for that microbe, I will make it available at xsquaredradio.com, and I think also you'll be able to get it through BBS Radio. We'll put it on our Facebook. If you're not a member of the, a friend of the Facebook for X Squared Radio, that's easy to do. Just look up X2-Radio at yahoo.com or bagnew at X2-Radio.com, and you'll be able to find that Facebook out there. No problem. Sign up, become a friend, and we'll send you regular information. If you're not part of our newsletter, please go to X2-Radio.com, sign up for the newsletter. We'll send these things out on an irregular but informative basis. So I want to get back to this clean energy battle. It's not just about cleaning up oil spills. You know, in the quality industry, I'm a Six Sigma black belt. A lot of you don't know what that is. It has nothing to do with martial arts. It has to do with applying mathematical, statistical tools to analyze processes, to find areas of wasted movement, wasted investment, to find variation in processes. And one of the things that that we come in contact with are a lot of different industries that are struggling with those very problems. And so we go around as experts to help various industries clean up their act, become more efficient and more profitable, more nimble, more agile. And one of the industries that's suffering badly because of it is the energy industry. What we try to do is not detect the problem after it happens, but to design in preventions. We call it pokayoke. It's Japanese. It means to prevent a problem from ever occurring. Design in the quality so that these kinds of things can happen. I don't know if you know how the oil spill happened on this rig in the Gulf of Mexico, but when you're drilling for oil, you often run into pockets of high-pressure methane gas. Well, that gas is very easily controlled by pumping down the center of the drill pipe heavyweight mud. Now, this mud is designed to be dense and push the cuttings that the drill is making as it's making the hole deeper or longer from side to side if they use directional drilling, but containing all of the high pressure sometimes it's sulfur dioxide and sometimes it's methane gas, from coming to the surface. It comes to the surface in the mud, and it can be filtered out that way. But this particular time, the managers of this rig, British Petroleum, went to government officials and asked to remove the mud from the rig so that they could make a move which would normally take more time with the mud. Excuse me. But they could make the move very quickly without the mud in the hole. The problem is that if you break through into a gas packet, there's nothing to hold the gas back. It comes blasting to the surface, going from liquid to gaseous form at about 1,000 times its original volume without blowing up because there's no oxygen in the hole. But when it comes to the surface and blows the steel off the head of the rig, it strikes oxygen. And if there's anything there to ignite it, it instantly bursts into flame, and you have a real problem. And that's what happened with this rig. It was a shortcut. It was a problem that they designed into the process by not following the regulations and rules and processes that have been put in place to keep this activity relatively safe. So when we talk about how many years it takes to get energy going, a lot of it has to do with the same oil companies. Do you know how many years it takes in court to get a wind farm built and operational? I witnessed a wind farm with 15 1-megawatt wind generators in Idaho that sat, built, brand spanking new and hooked up, that sat unused for 2 years. While they fought through court to try to get these wind generators turned on. They finally did. But that's what it comes down to. Do you know that it's still illegal in Washington State to blend biodiesel at the pump with simple and safe static mixers? They still require splash blending and designated tanks for each blend. What station could afford to even carry biodiesel blends for their customers with outdated regulations like that? Because those regulations were put in place and lobbied for by the oil companies to keep biodiesel from getting to you, to keep you from access to clean burning fuels. Do you know that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has approved not one single electric vehicle for highway use in America except for the Tesla Lotus. At $110,000 a copy, I doubt that that's very effective. Not one other electric vehicle has been approved. Did you know that the Department of Motor Vehicles in each state requires electric vehicle manufacturers to prove they have a network of maintenance stations within 25 miles of every owner of an electric vehicle before the vehicles can be licensed in that state? How convenient is that? These are regulations you can change with simple proposals and resolutions in your own states. Any citizen can bring one to vote by simply following the procedures that are practically free. All you have to do is draft the resolution, go to a city council meeting, and begin the process. You have the power to change everything and demand electric vehicles or affordable biodiesel in your states. It can happen only if you take action. If it wasn't for the regulations and blockades set up by the oil companies through their bought and paid for politicians, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in today. We wouldn't have the mess in the Gulf if it wasn't for BP bypassing proven safety procedures for using that heavy mud to contain the high-pressure methane gas. There wouldn't be a spill destroying premium fishing habitats and the economy on American soil. You'd be horrified to find out what happens and habitats they have decimated in foreign countries whose people have no such voice or the ability to choose. If I were you, I'd follow Leilani's admonition and wake up, and I'd answer the call. And by the way, don't criticize racing. They haven't used gasoline in years. 100% methanol, which is clean burning and pollution free. Take some time and money and do something about it. If you let government take over BP's assets in the Gulf, then you give them the power to do the same thing to your company and the one you work for. The choice is yours and yours alone. Do not abdicate it to the White House. Now, every once in a while we get fired up about local politics. This happens to be national politics, and it's hitting home. I like shrimp. I like the fish that comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. Lots of restaurants up here in our state rely on that fish that's caught down in the Gulf of Mexico. And that fish is going to go away. One of the chemicals that they put on that oil sinks it to the bottom. Oh, it doesn't show up on the beaches. It doesn't show up in the waves and in the sea from satellite view. No, it drops to the bottom. It is absorbed by the clams and the shrimp and the lobsters. It's absorbed by the sea life that lives on the bottom. It kills the reefs. It kills the plant life that lives on the bottom and all the microbes and plankton upon which all that sea life relies. What you heard in the YouTube about the microbes is absolutely true. The chemicals that they're using to try to gather up this spill, to clean it up, to contain it, are more toxic than the oil itself. I just want you to know I'm passionate about this, if you can't hear it in my voice, and I think that you guys have the solution out there. I think you have the strength. I think you have the will, and I think you can do it, and I have faith in you. So we're here at X Squared Radio, and we're Earth explorers, and when we find a mess, we try to clean it up, and this is a mess, and I'm asking for your help, for your support. So go to xsquaredradio.com, go to bbsradio.com, do a little bit of research on Google, and by all means, write your congressman, write your senator. They will listen with enough of you getting to them. Now I'm going to play a little music here as we take a break, about 5 minutes, and I think it'll be appropriate. So hang in there. We'll be right back after this. glorious after all. Welcome back to X Squared Radio Hour 2. In our last hour, we discussed the Gulf oil spill and its possible ramifications on our ecology. We had a couple of spokespeople, Leilani Munter, as well as an expert out there trying to make people aware that there's a microbe that could help us clean up the spill while they plug it. And by the way, I don't even know if they're really trying to plug it. I mean, mud and golf balls, let's get serious, people. Go after it with concrete. That's what we need to do. Plug that well and abandon it. In this hour, I want to talk about preparedness. I recently spoke to one of the founders of 1-800-PREPARE.com, Paul Faust. And I had a short interview with him on the phone. I thought it was so good that I will go ahead and play it for you now. So stand by. Here we go. Earth Explorers, I have often spoken to you about emergency preparedness. With me on the phone right now is the founder and business development manager for 1-800-PREPARE.com, Paul Faust. Paul, how did you develop the idea for 1-800-PREPARE.com?
1-800-PREPARE.com is something that, I've been thinking about for a while, as well as my partner. Been a volunteer firefighter, been around the security business, and it's something that's always fascinated me and something that I always knew that we needed in this country. And my partner and I sat down and decided to combine two of the things we love, emergency preparedness and marketing and entrepreneurship. And we also happen to be in the vanity phone number business, and we understand the power of brand and the power of brands to change and affect people. So we sat down and said, there's a hole in the marketplace here. It's something we care about, something we can make a change in. Let's start 1-800-PREPARE.com and give consumers, give people in this country an easy place to go to get prepared.
You know, we only need look at this year's news to see why preparedness is so necessary. Now, I don't mean a few extra bags of chips or cans of soup. I'm talking about a long-term, sealed and safe resource that will save your life and the lives of your family and neighbors. Paul, how have you made packaging supplies so the average person living in an apartment or working in an office can be ready with everything they need to be healthy and warm for 3 or 4 days?
That's a great question. You know, I look at preparedness and we look at preparedness a little differently than some other people might look at it. Some people think of preparedness as just preparing for the big earthquake or preparing for a tornado. But to me, preparedness is really preparing for everyday life's what-ifs. You know, we don't know if where I live, the chance of hitting an earthquake are slim. But there's lots of situations, whether it be a house fire, whether it be a blackout, whether it be a chemical explosion, whether it be a terror attack in New York, that we need to be prepared for. So we have a wide selection of kits that are pre-made for people that don't want to build their own, that include the basic items you would need. And we also have an ever-expanding line of individual products that people could buy for those people that want to either completely build their own kits for their home, their car, their office, or they want to buy a pre-made kit, but they want to supplement. They want to add more food. They want to add more tools. They could do that as well. Our plan and our goal is to make kits available at all levels and for all people. So you want the basic kit, you come, you know, we've got that. You want a more advanced system, we've got that. So we're continually adding to the line.
And what's your mission with 1-800-PREPARE.com?
That's a great question, because this is not just a business for us. As a volunteer firefighter, my partner and co-founder, Greg Hammerschlag, is an EMT. This was all founded on a mission. We are building a business, but we have a mission to change the culture of preparedness in this country. There's a few great things that come out of that. Number one, we save lives. Number two, the more people we get prepared, the easier it is on our rescue personnel and our first responders, because they can go deal with the real problem. Three, the more people we get prepared, the more stuff we sell, the more good we can do, the more fire departments we can help, the more charities we could support. Right now we're supporting, helping to support a search and rescue dog that's going from puppy through full training. She'll be FEMA deployable shortly. So the entire business is about doing well by doing good, and really trying to change the culture in this country. This is a topic that should be talked about. It's cool to talk about. You should be prepared. So it's really all it is a mission. beyond just a business.
Do you have, in addition to food and blankets and tools and things like that, do you have information that people can access? Like, gee, how do I purify water? Where do I go to find support in case of a tornado or an earthquake, a power outage, a flood? Where do I go for help? How can I learn how to be have a better preparedness mindset?
That's a great question. We have an information and resource section on the site, which is undergoing lots of changes. It will be added to on a daily, weekly basis. We have a team of experts, some of the most recognized names in the country, and we're adding more all the time that will be expert advisors to our company. We have an active blog. Again, the information and resource section, we're going to have a series of videos. There's downloads. There's going to be checklists. There's ebooks. So we view 1-800-PREPARE.com not as an e-commerce site, but as a resource. When you think preparedness from the very basic to the most advanced, we want you to come to 1-800-PREPARE.com, know that you can learn, you can get some downloads. If you want to buy some stuff, great. We'd love to have you as a customer. But that you know there's a safe place to go where you can get what you need from a knowledge perspective and a product perspective.
And what about the quality of the products? Are we talking about meals ready to eat? Are we talking about dehydrated food or filtered water packs?
Yeah, there's all sorts of products. And again, it's an ever-expanding line. We could have 15,000, 20,000 products on the site tomorrow if we wanted to. But it's a slow process of putting the right items on, making sure that we could manage them well, and also not giving people too much. There are people out there that understand preparedness and can filter through all this. For most people, and as we try and expand the conversation, if we give them too much, they shut down. So we're adding products as, you know, slowly and purposefully to add different categories, different levels, whether it be different tools, different first aid kits, different kind of prepackaged kits, different types of emergency food, whether it be 5-year food and water or 25-year food. So we are adding more and more, and with the guidance of our experts, we'll continually grow what we have.
Well, we here at X-Squared Radio have the utmost support and respect for entrepreneurs who lead the way into a new understanding of self-reliance. Paul, it has been a pleasure to have you on X-Squared Radio.
Hey, Brooks, one more thing before I leave, if I might, and it's been a pleasure. I thank you very much for having me. One thing I would like to do is I'm going to create a coupon code on my site that if someone goes to 1-800-PREPARE.com and there's anything that they want to buy, any items they want, all they have to do is enter the coupon code Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, and they will get 10% off anything they order. That's for your listeners.
Outstanding. That's the kind of participation we like to see. Thank you so much, Paul. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks for your time, Brooks.
So there you have it, Earth Explorers. What we are talking about here is emergency preparedness. So I want to let you know that I don't make any money off of this. No commission, no profit, no nothing. This gives you 10% off if you put in the coupon code Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, by going to 1-800-PREPARE.com. So we're going to talk a little bit this hour about what Earth changes are coming up. But first, Chuck is on from Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Chuck.
Hey.
How are you?
Real happy to meet you there, Dr. Brooks. Thank you. I have a question about the Gulf.
Sure.
If we had the technology, which I'm sure we do, why have we not yet plugged that hole?
Well, because
politics has something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's politics or economics, Chuck. I'll tell you. I worked in the oil and gas industry for many years. I did my PhD on oil and gas exploration. I can tell you they're probably trying to save that well. They want to put it back into production. They're not approaching it from the point of view of plugging that well, or they wouldn't be going at it with mud and golf balls. They'd be going at it with concrete to plug it.
Exactly. Okay, let me ask you a question. What role, in your opinion, what role does the government have in this, or should they have in this?
Well, of course, anytime there's an ecological disaster, I can tell you, we drilled a well in Kentucky one time, and we were sort of prepared, but we weren't prepared for this. We blew a 4-inch stream of oil across Highway 90 when we hit the oil structure. And the EPA immediately came in, and we had to shovel every single yard of dirt into barrels and haul it away. Now, you can't tell where that spill was today because of those efforts taken then. If the government had any teeth at all, they would be all over BP, making them shift whatever resources they had. I don't care if they have to haul a 500-foot-long tanker there full of concrete. It should be there in 24 hours. They should have a batch plant on site. And I don't care if they have to pour a mountain of concrete on top of that well at the bottom of the Gulf. It should be plugged immediately.
You and I share the same sentiments when I ask about politics being involved. What I'm saying is, when you get elected to office, it takes big money. To get reelected to office, it takes big money. And to do that, you need money from people like BP. So it makes me wonder how much we are pressuring them and why are we not pressuring them?
Well, I know that it makes it sound like it takes money to get reelected, but the real world, it takes votes to get reelected. And in order to get exposed to the people, you need the money to be able to reach those people. Now, the way our Constitution is set up, originally the House of Representatives was to mimic the House of Commons in the British parliamentary system. The Senate was to mimic the House of Lords. Senators were originally appointed by state legislatures. That way they would be beholden only to the legislators in the state, which are locally elected, and not so much running national campaigns the way they do today. Congressmen were designed to be public servants. That's why they only served 2 years. It was a burden for them. We kept that 2 year. So what happens is, as soon as that guy is elected, he has to go right back into campaign mode. He has to go right back into fundraising mode.
Positively. So
what we should do is we should ask for a constitutional amendment to change the term of a congressman from 2 years to 4 years.
Right. If you run for president, it's a 4-year term, but you and I both know it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of votes to get elected. But once you're elected, the first thing you have to do is think about being reelected. In my humble opinion, we should have a 1-term limit for president, perhaps 6 years. Then it takes the politics out of it.
Well, I could see that, but it takes a while for a president to get his legs. Frankly, I think the way that our executive branch is set up, with a single president and an almost ineffectual vice president, is antiquated.
Right.
I think we need a presidential council. It takes most corporations have a president and multiple vice presidents to handle each division. So I think we should go to a presidential council, and that should be much, much more sensitive to domestic issues and not just foreign issues.
Yeah, you know something else? Okay, I just read, and it made a lot of sense to me. I'm reading a book by Lee Iacocca called Where Have All Our Leaders Gone? And he suggested, and I'm inclined to believe him, that when you run for office, we all know that it's not the president in himself who does anything but the folks that work with him, the cabinet, that he should actually, during the election, he should show his entire cabinet, who he would name and what they would bring to the table. And that made perfect sense to me.
You know, well, I understand that. In our industry, at least in politics in our nation, we call it a quid pro quo. You actually cannot promise a cabinet position until after you're elected. What it prevents is it prevents cronyism, where those who might already be in office being promised a cabinet position, it might be a move up for them, can't lobby for you and perhaps slant the process.
Right. Well,
I think the president already got himself in trouble with that this last week by promising a position.
Here in Pennsylvania, he sure did. Here in Pennsylvania,
that's right.
He did.
And that's a violation of law. He could be in big trouble over that.
Right, he sure could. Quid pro quo. It was real nice chatting with you. My friend Robert told me to call you, so I just wanted to chat with you about the Gulf oil spill because I think something's really wrong there. And you suggested they're more inclined to worry about saving the well than closing the well. So it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
I appreciate it, Chuck, and call back any time. You're always welcome.
Okay, Brooke, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. There are some other events that are happening that you may not know about. The Atlantic storm season could produce as many as 14 hurricanes this year. By the way, hurricane season starts in 3 months. In 3 months. And it usually takes place in the Gulf. If we don't get this oil spill cleaned up, a storm could spread it further than you can imagine. The U.S. government's top climate agency predicted on Thursday, setting the scene for potentially the most intense season since 2005. You remember what happened in 2005, a little hurricane called Katrina. In its first forecast for the storm season that begins next Tuesday, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that's the NOAA, forecast 14 to 23 named storms, with 8 to 14 developing into hurricanes, making it one of the most active ever. 3 to 7 of those storms could be major Category 3 or above hurricanes, with winds of more than 110 miles per hour, the agency said, echoing earlier predictions from meteorologists for a particularly severe season that could disrupt U.S. oil, gas, and refinery operations in the Gulf of Mexico. In addition to the risk that major hurricanes can pose to about one quarter of U.S. oil production and more than one tenth of natural gas output offshore in the Gulf, this year's storms threaten to complicate efforts to combat the environmental disasters of BP's Gushing oil well. That's just for starters. You remember recently we had a volcanic eruption in Iceland. A second, much larger volcano in Iceland is showing signs that it may be about to erupt, scientists have warned. Since the start of the Eyjafjallajökull eruption, which caused cancellations of thousands of flights in Europe because of a giant ash cloud, and by the way, that happened because the eruption happened underneath a glacier. So when the water hit the molten lava, it burst into steam, blasting the ash cloud high into the atmosphere. There has been much speculation about neighboring Katla. That's right, Katla. An initial research paper by the University College of London Institute for Risk and Disaster Reduction said, analysis of the seismic energy released around Katla over the last decade or so is interpreted as providing evidence of a rising intrusive magma body on the western flank of the volcano. Earlier seismic energy release at Katla is associated with the inflation of the volcano, which indicates it is close to failure. Although this does not appear to be linked to seismicity around the other volcano, it added, we conclude that given the high frequency of Katla activity, an eruption in the short term is a strong possibility, the report said. It continues, it is likely to be preceded by new earthquake activity. Presently, There is no unusual seismicity under Katla. Icelandic President Ólafur Grímsson has warned governments about Europe that a significant eruption at the volcano is close. We, that is Iceland, have prepared. It is high time for European governments and airline authorities all over Europe and the world to start planning for the eventual Katla eruption, he said. The UCL scientists, engineers, and statisticians also criticized their response to the earlier eruption. The impact of the eruption on regional airspace could have been predicted and better prepared for, as the growing problem of aircraft ash cloud encounters has been recognized for decades, the report added. By the way, for those of you that aren't familiar with what that is, when these ash clouds are pushed up to 40 or 50,000 feet, it is very precarious and dangerous for jet aircraft to fly through them. The compressors, which are those big fans you see in the front of the jet engine at the airport, will smash and spin that ash inside the jet engine and can even cause catastrophic failure. You wouldn't want that to happen on your trip back from Amsterdam now, would you? Similarly, the potential for ash clouds, specifically from Icelandic volcanoes, to interfere with air traffic in UK, European, and North Atlantic airspace was appreciated by the aviation industry well before the start of the last eruption, it said. The response to the ash clouds' arrival in UK and adjacent airspace was entirely reactive and therefore less effective than it should have been. They should have had new airways already set up, already designed to handle this kind of rerouting of the traffic. That was the problem. They didn't have any airways set up. There was no way to move thousands of flights from Europe to the U.S. and back any other way except a high polar route. By the way, if you don't fly the polar route, it costs a lot more fuel to fly those routes. So these are contingencies that must be taken into consideration. These are earth changes that are getting ready to come, and I want you to be prepared. That's why we researched for weeks and we found 1-800-PREPARE.com. Why do I like the site? Listen, I went to all kinds of emergency preparedness sites. They will sell you wheat. They will sell you beans. They will sell you MREs. They will sell you anything you want to buy. But they aren't packaged correctly. The sites aren't set up so that you can buy using almost any kind of credit, including PayPal. 1-800-PREPARE.com is set up with pricing that the average person can afford. To get set up with a 72-hour pack costs you less than $30. Less than $30 makes the difference between you being a burden on your local emergency response team, your firefighters, your EMTs, and being self-supporting, able to move to a safer area. And I'm not talking about just tornadoes, although hurricanes are very, very famous for spinning off tornadoes, a la Hugo and Katrina. These supercells that move on up into the continent after they make landfall can be almost as devastating as the hurricane itself. Now, the other thing I want you to prepare for is fuel prices. You know what happened after Katrina. I can tell you one story that was just amazing. One of my coworkers, when I was a quality engineer for Lear, took some of his money, some of his self-directed IRA, and he invested in fuel futures when it looked like Katrina was going to make a turn toward land. He speculated that the refineries in that area would get hit and that the price of gasoline would go through the roof. Well, long story short, it paid off for him. And when he finished, he retired. That's how much money he made off of that disaster. But I don't suspect you all will prepare in that manner. So when fuel prices get back up to $5, $6, maybe even $7 a gallon like they are in Europe, By the way, there's a high degree of jealousy for us in the United States. We're further away from the oil sources than they are, and yet we pay a third the price that they do for oil. And you know what the domestic oil companies do, if there are such a thing anymore? Rather than produce domestic oil, which costs them money to produce, and it's very cheap for them, cheap, like $20 a barrel to produce oil in the United States, they buy the foreign oil, which is a very high quality oil, and just mark it up and resell it. The beauty is that they get to sell the domestic oil for the same price. Even though it only costs them $20 a barrel to produce, they get to sell it for $80. And now you know why the oil companies put $8 billion a quarter in their pockets, and why they sit there in defiance, not unlike Tony Stark in the latest Iron Man 2 movie, before Congress, blatantly saying that they're not gouging, and it's none of their business if the oil companies make $8 or $9 or $12 billion a quarter in extra profits off the misery and the need of the American people. I can tell you, when I was demonstrating our electric vehicles last year, I had one of the reporters for NPR drive the car around the racetrack. When she got back, she got out and she said, "I want to buy this car right now." I said, "Well, unfortunately, I'm not allowed by government regulations to sell you that car right now, but I'm curious as to why you want it so badly." She said, "I'm a reporter, and I drive about 60 miles a day with my job, sometimes a little further to get the stories and make the reports. I had to stop dry cleaning my clothes. I had to stop going to the movies. I had to pass up desserts because I had to buy gas for my car so I could do my job. And it made me mad." I said, "Why did it make you mad?" She said, "Because I knew there was no darn good reason for it. And I don't want to be put in that position again, ever. I want to take control of my own life and my own resources. I want an electric car so I'm never put in that position again." I found that so profound, that here was a reporter speaking her mind, and believe me, she had some passion behind her voice. She was mad because she was at the mercy of someone else for her transportation costs to be able to do her job. I know every one of you out there are in the same position that she is. And I know that you're watching this Gulf spill on the news and you're saying, what in the world could be so hard about it? The water's 5,000 feet deep. It's as calm as a summer pond. It's not storming now. It's easy to work in. The weather's wonderful. It's only 50 miles off the coast. That's a little over 2-3 hours by boat ride. This could be fixed. And with the resources that BP has at their disposal, they should marshal their proper resources into place and take care of it right away. Because in 3 months, it's not going to be the calm summer pond it is now. It's going to have 100-mile-an-hour winds and storm surges, and then the excuses will really fly. If we had a responsible leadership of our government, they would be all over this. They would demand that it was fixed right now. It's a spill in our own backyard, inside our own waters, not in international waters. It's our mess. It's not BP's. We should demand that they clean it up. And while we're in the process, now that we're awake and all charged up here on X Squared Radio, while you're here getting squared, you ought to be getting prepared. Because these changes are coming. These costs are coming to you. And if you've got that extra $30, I highly recommend a 72-hour emergency preparedness kit. It comes with food and water and it comes with antiseptics in case you are injured by glass or a puncture wound. Do you know if you step on a nail and you get Clostridium tetani in your system, you're going to die? People in the wild and in undeveloped countries die from infections from simple cuts on their feet, on their hands, in areas where they can't get them clean. And when there's no clean water around, it's easy to get an infection. But a mild amount of preparation, just a simple amount of ordinary pink eye powder. Didn't know that was a great antibiotic, did you? It is. It's one of the best topical antibiotics in the world. But a little tube of Neosporin wouldn't cost you more than $2 or $3. If it was in your kit, you could keep yourself from getting an infection and getting a very bad infection and maybe even hepatitis. So I'm just talking to you while things are calm, while the economy seems to be recovering. Where? I have no idea. There are 50,000 people out of work here in Charlotte, North Carolina. 50,000 people out of work. And while the census workers are being hired and fired sometimes 3 and 4 times, why? Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Because every time they're rehired, it counts as a new job created for the administration. It adds up. The census workers, tens of thousands of them all across the nation, are being hired and fired multiple times to make the numbers look greater. They're cooking the books, people. Unemployment is much higher than we expected. 9.9% is what it is in good cities. Here in the South and in some cities, it's as high as 18%. It hasn't been that high since the Great Depression. And I'll tell you this, the rural areas weren't really affected by the Depression the way the cities were. They were agricultural communities. There was always food being grown. There were ways of bartering labor for food. The rural communities didn't suffer like they're suffering now, because now we've specialized our labor. We've specialized our ability to provide on a community basis. Unfortunately, we keep outsourcing those things. We are just becoming a nation of service providers. The actual supplier is overseas. The actual buyer is someone who has a job. But the people in between are left in the lurch. It's a bad design, people. We need to bring the jobs home. How do we do that? Well, we don't do that by starting up textile mills again. We don't do that by starting up buggy whip companies again. We do that by starting new industry. We do that by our communities demanding that electric cars go into production, by demanding that wind generators be put on available hills and coastlines so that we can take advantage of that free energy. We start by demanding that our coastal cities start utilizing ocean wave generators. You didn't even know about those, did you? These float out in the water. They're anchored to the bottom. They make energy based on the regular swells of water passing by. They use floats. The floats going up and down, turn generators and generate electricity. Some of these floating complexes can power whole islands, small towns. That means that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they have clean, renewable energy. Rivers that flow. You don't have to build a dam and hydroelectric generators. They have generators now that work off the bottom currents. They run and don't obstruct the flow of water. They don't get in the way of fish. They don't change the water tables in the area, but they generate electricity based on moving water. All of these technologies are available right now. So let's talk about it. Robin, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just wanted to take a quick moment out. I was hearing about today where was Elizabeth Birnbaum, the director of the Interior Department of Minerals Management Service, resigned today over this. Yeah, the resignation. Are we expected to believe that this is the only person here that we can point a finger to that totally mismanaged and misappropriated and missed everything, this oil spill from day one?
Well, maybe she was trying to get something done and couldn't, and she's resigning in frustration.
Well, I don't see where, I didn't hear that, you know. I heard that she's resigning, but if she is resigning in frustration, then shouldn't we be expecting the people who, let's say, are the problem that she's resigning because of?
Maybe she gets to keep her pension because she doesn't say anything about the inaction that she was getting when she tried to get a budget to go in and clean up the mess.
Is that right?
Well, I'm speculating as much as anyone else is. When these resignations come, I can tell you in politics, it's more a sacrificial lamb than it is action. They don't get any action out of resignations. That's just something for the public, so the public can say, oh, she was the problem. So now I see what the problem is. Now that she's out of the way, we can get something done. I don't believe it for a minute.
No, honestly, I don't believe it either. There's no public here that I know of, or no one I'm talking about, that would be satisfied with that or be able to sit back and say, okay, the problem is out now solved. I mean, this oil spill has been totally mismatched from day one. BP has unlimited resources to have been able to stop this, financial and supplies and equipment and everything else. They could have gotten anything out. They could have gotten the best experts in the world there in 3 days and had them working on it.
It's amazing that you use the word from day one, because the administration, about 15 days after the disaster, started using that very phrase. We've been on this since day one, and it was absolutely false. By the way, President Obama spends 5 hours a day sometimes on the golf course during this disaster. In times past, we've had a leader where the buck stopped at that desk, and it doesn't now.
Well, ultimately, it's the government that regulates all this stuff, okay? So the fact that the regulations or their removal of certain requirements, I mean, it goes to them. They are responsible, too, and they have oversight on this.
Well, those government regulations were in place. It is not legal to do what they did with that rig. You're not allowed to remove the mud from the hole to speed up operations and changing bits and things like that down in the hole. That mud is there specifically to contain high pressure liquefied methane gas and other gases like sulfur dioxide.
I thought they were given a special dispensation in this case to be able to do that.
Yes, they were, but it was a government regulation. And what BP did is they went to the government inspector and said, look, we want to remove this mud so it'll speed things up and we can get this done. And the inspector agreed. But the regulations were in place. They just weren't enforced.
What gave that? Does anybody know what gave that inspector the authority to do this? I mean, since it seems like it was probably a good precaution to take in the past, and since they did take it in the past, they didn't have these issues when they did this. I mean,
well,
who was this inspector?
That's
a
good question.
I mean, I'd like to start seeing somebody, you know, with some names. I don't want to hear titles, okay? Some fictitious title out there that we're all supposed to listen to. I want to hear who's the guy that was in charge. Who was that inspector? I wanted to be able to go to that inspector. I wanted to be able to start.
I don't know who
it
was, but I think we could do some investigation and find out who that inspector was. I would say that he probably doesn't have a job anymore, and he's probably working some rig up in Alaska right now.
Yeah, well, I don't want to assume anything when it comes to stuff like this, because I think what gets us in trouble in the American population is they assume somebody's taking care of it. And what we're finding out, I mean, this is 5 weeks later, nobody, it's still not being taken care of. It's right in our face.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah,
and I remember what Leilani said in her statement, that the Exxon Valdez spill was similarly disastrous. And although there were $500 million in reparations that they were supposed to make to the fishing community, by the time all the lawsuits got done, 20% of the fishermen that were supposed to get paid were already dead.
Well, I'm genuinely incensed on this one, and I'm really disappointed in the media. Although they say, well, we need to get updates every 15 minutes. They're upset because they just can't report news faster. They don't really care what the news is. But I think the public, when you see these photographs coming in, and you're not getting them from the mainstream media, when you see these things where these dolphins are dying, these fish are dying, I mean, these families are just totally bankrupt. When you see, you know, private citizens who are going out there trying to help, coming back with photographs like this, and you're not getting this from the mainstream media, you almost want to turn off the mainstream media because it's not serving the public anymore. I don't know what it's serving, but it certainly isn't helping us. And I think we need to wise up to it. The fact is that there is the Internet. You are getting more information out from that. And you are getting people who are active and high-profile people who are active in this and who are taking pictures and bringing back information. It's a lot more reliable and a lot more pertinent to what's going on than what we're receiving right now. You know, not that I want this to be a discussion about the mainstream media, but, I mean, when's enough enough?
Well, you have to understand the mainstream media operates off of selling airtime, and they sell commercial time. And I don't know if you've turned on the television lately, but BP runs a whole lot of commercials on those television stations. If you start slamming your bread and butter, those commercials go away. That's what it's all about.
Well, I'm hoping I'm not the only one who can call in on this tonight. And I hope I can hear from other people who have some, you know, a perspective on this too, or, you know, will back me up. But I really thank you for the time and the call, and I'll let you continue on with the program. Thanks for letting me
in. Thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it very much. Call back anytime.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Well, Earth Explorers, we don't normally make this program about political issues, and this isn't really from the way I'm looking at it because I have some intimate knowledge of the industry. Many of you, probably most of you, have never been on an oil rig when a sulfur dioxide alarm goes off. You know, that gas, if you breathe it in, your first breath, you are on your knees. Your second breath, you're on your face. And if somebody doesn't get to you, you're dead. When that alarm goes off, you peel that SCBA off or that filter off, and you get it on your face right away and get off of that rig until the mud gets in place to contain that leak. When you're out there on the water, 50 miles from shore, there are a few lifeboats, but you live there 24 hours a day when you're on that shift. You're isolated. You can't see land. It's way over the horizon. And that rig runs 24/7. So when you're working that shift, and that Kelly's turning, and you're holding on to 20,000 feet of steel that goes through the water, down through the sea floor to where the structure is, and you're cleaning that out and you're producing oil, let me tell you, it's a little bit like riding a bucking bronc. And it can be a little scary. It can wear on your nerves after a while. That's why the pay is so good, because it's hazardous. My friends used to go out to the oil rigs and work the summers, and they would come back with enough money to buy the cars we only dreamed about. But it's hard work, and it's risky, and it's dangerous, and it's dirty. And out there in the middle of the Gulf, there's no room for taking chances like this. And they took a chance, and they lost. And I can tell you from experience, you never, ever, ever want to remove the mud from the hole. It's the only thing between you and that compressed gas that's down there in that well. Now that we have an oil spill leaking into the ocean, coming to the surface and making its way toward the coast, waters are calm, people. This is a nice, long, meandering river of oil out there in the Gulf of Mexico. When the winds kick up, remember, June starts in a couple days. Hurricane season starts the 1st of September. July, August, September. Boom, you're there. 4 months away from hurricane season. If they haven't got it cleaned up in 40 days, they haven't got it plugged in 40 days, what makes you think they're going to have it plugged in 4 months? I'm not very confident unless somebody high up picks up the phone and says, Mr. CEO, I want this thing cleaned up. You have 7 days, and then the military's coming in. That's our water out there, and I want it cleaned up. That's what needs to be said. Now, I don't know what we're going to do about a volcano up in Iceland. By the way, the Katla volcano is about 10 times the size of the last volcanic eruption. The only reason that that volcanic eruption was a problem was because it erupted underneath a glacier. Once that lava hit that ice, it built up pressure underneath that ice cap and blew. That's why we had the problem. This next volcano has a river, an ocean of magma heading for it. If it blows, it could be much larger than the other volcano. If you have plans to go to Europe, I would make some contingencies. If you're relying on business coming in from Europe, I would make some contingencies. And when it comes to those 14 to 23 storms coming into the Gulf, if I were you, and I am, I would call 1-800-PREPARE.com. I would go to their website, 1-800-PREPARE.com, and I would buy some supplies. MREs, maybe a water filter, put it in one of your kids' old book bags, put it by the closet near the front door so you can grab it and head out the door. People, you have nothing to lose. Hope that you buy that and never need it. So, when it comes to emergency preparedness, sometimes it takes talking like an emergency. I don't mean to be an alarmist, but I'm telling you, all you have to do is watch the news. These summertime storms that came through last week, there were people displaced by that. Some of the people were prepared, most were not. Most lost everything. And they were a burden upon the emergency preparedness crews because they didn't even have so much as one meal with them. They didn't have a change of clothes packed. They didn't have an old pair of tennis shoes that they could put in a book bag and make their way out so that they could at least take care of themselves and their family for a few days. Now, I'm going to caution you not to go overboard on this. I know there are a lot of organizations out there that ask you to keep a 2-year supply of food, and that's fine. It's fine to give away. But if you have to move somewhere, you're not going to be able to take that food storage with you. It's going to stay behind. You might want to put some of that food in a forward position, like your parents' farm, or maybe a relative in another valley or something. If you have to move out of an earthquake zone or a tidal wave zone or a storm surge zone, you're not going to be able to take those barrels of wheat with you. You're not going to be packing 5-gallon buckets of beans with you. You're going to take one backpack with enough to get from where you are to where you want to be. Somewhere safe, on your own, taking care of yourself, and maybe a couple more people. So if you've got that food storage in your possession, you can take care of yourself, and you can take care of someone else that you love. That's all I'm asking. That's why we spent this hour on emergency preparedness. So take care of yourselves, take care of someone else, and it's a much happier ability to survive. That's all I'm talking about. Not trying to be an alarmist here. I'm not trying to get you all excited. I'm just trying to get you to take some action and take care of yourselves. So be safe. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back after just a few minutes here. Just give me a second to select up some music. I lost track of where I was on my iPod. So here we go. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature, silver seed, to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature, silver seed, to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad you're joining us tonight. Our first 2 hours have certainly been hot, let me tell you. We've talked about some of the current events that are out there, not just the spill in the Gulf, but also emergency preparedness. If you're just joining us, welcome to the program. This is Hour 3 of X Squared Radio. We'll be here for about 55 minutes, so if you want to call in, be part of the program, it's 415-762-1161. Pardon me. 415-762-1161. Anywhere on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us. 415-762-1161. I also want you to pay attention. Go to our Facebook, X Squared Radio Facebook, or Brooks Agnew Facebook. We've got some really interesting stuff up there on this oil spill. Leilani Munter's video testimony is there, some of the photographs that she personally took while she was out with some of the fishermen down there in the Gulf. And we also want to let you know that the ebook for Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is out. You can get to it by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Pick up the ebook. All of the drawings and photographs are in color. That book is in heavy editing right now, getting ready to come out in print. We have been very, very satisfied with the way the editing is going. Looks like this book is going to go traditional method instead of POD. We'll see what happens. It depends on you, of course. But you can get your copy of the ebook, which gives you 25% off of the printed version, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Also, if you're interested in the subject of 2012 or the origin and destiny of the Earth, such great subjects, the Ark of Millions of Years trilogy is available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walden Books, all of those stores, but you can also get an autographed copy at arcofmillionsofyears.com. Now, the reason I encourage you to do that, not only do you get the autographed copies, you get the trilogy, special shipping on that trilogy, and you get the first two volumes in audio version for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you. You can listen to them on the way to work, put them on your iPod or your other MP3 device, and just listen to the book while you have the new copies on your shelf. So if you're interested in the subject, Forward Magazine called them the most comprehensive work ever written on the subject of 2012 end times. Get yourself prepared, have a little entertainment, and pick up the books. This hour, we talked a little bit about the X-37B passing over. Tomorrow, which is the 31st, it is going to be passing over the eastern seaboard three times tomorrow night, somewhere around 9:30 p.m., and then again at just after 10 o'clock, and again just after 11 o'clock. So you'll get to see that spacecraft coming over the Earth three times in one night. Pretty rare. It's a little faint, about as bright as one of the stars of the Big Dipper, not as bright as Jupiter, like the International Space Station. And if you feel like getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you can see the International Space Station come over. It's very bright. But the X-37B is the new space shuttle that was launched by the Air Force. This is a secret mission. We have no idea what it costs, and we don't know what's on board. It's going to be in orbit for 9 months. Now, we have dedicated a couple of programs back on the weaponization of space. We've had Alfred Lambermont Weber on the program talking about it back when we were getting ready to drop a projectile onto the moon. Many people call it the bombing of the moon. It was a kinetic experiment where the soil blown out into the atmosphere, as it were, of the moon would be spectrographically analyzed to check for the presence of water and other elements. That mission was a success, and they determined that there was ice in the soil of the moon. Now, the interesting thing about this, many people don't pay a lot of attention to this stuff, but the interesting thing about this is now we have confirmation of H3. That is a hydrogen 3 molecule, very, very good at producing energy. We have chemical oxygen to the weight of 25% by weight, and we have ice in the lunar soil. Well, it doesn't take a great chemist to figure out if you have energy and you have oxygen and you have water, then you have the possibility of making a habitat on the moon very easily. That means that with a few raw materials in the proper proportions, a shelter could be built on the moon and a permanent settlement. Now, this is a lot different than the International Space Station. For one thing, it's about 245,000 miles further away from Earth than the International Space Station. It's more stable, and guess what? You get gravity. Now, it's 1/6 what we have here on Earth. But you don't have the debilitating problems of weightlessness, even for short term, especially for long term in the International Space Station. You don't have that problem on the astronauts. And it's easy, much easier, to build shelter on solid ground that can withstand the electromagnetic radiation from the sun. Once you pass the Van Allen radiation belts, you are exposed to full-on high-speed protons emitted by the sun and other bodies outside of our heliosphere, which now have free access to the Earth now that the solar wind is so low, due to a very quiet sun. We don't have any idea why that's happening either. But now you're on a satellite that's 245,000 miles away from Earth, always facing Earth. Yes, you do have darkness and light, but you've got oxygen, and you have water, and you have power. So you can make artificial light, you can make artificial heat, and you never run out. You have an endless supply. Now, the moon, because it has far less gravity, and of course, an almost non-existent atmosphere, makes an excellent place to relaunch heavy lift vehicles. That means that a steady stream of projectiles could be lifted into space, launched toward the moon, captured in moon orbit, brought to the surface, processed, built in low gravity, in zero, almost zero atmosphere, above the surface, below the surface, and then reassembled into larger payloads and launched much cheaper into deep space or to leapfrog to other planets like Mars. Now, this makes not only logical space exploration sense, it makes logical economic sense as well. The payback from efforts like this is usually about anywhere from 10 to 30 to 1. That means that if it costs $1 gazillion to get to the moon, you're going to get $10 gazillion back in economy and technology and innovations. Now, one thing is for sure. I'll make this statement, and I'll ask you to call in 415-762-1161, and we'll talk about it. 415-762-1161. Do we or do we not have the realization that the nation that controls the moon will control the Earth? To have control of space that far out, a sizable colony, maybe as many as 50,000 people working as a community, developing new technologies, having access not only to radiation but elements that we don't have here on the Earth in large supply. We can actually perform fairly well-developed asteroid mining. Hauling an asteroid to the moon makes a lot more sense than trying to haul an asteroid to Earth. The moon is much closer to these kinds of things. You could develop a safe community, work on the moon or within the moon, and be able to take space exploration to the next level. So we've toyed with the idea here that our defense budget is entirely too large, $1.3 trillion, compared to about $170 million for the space program per year. Sometimes that gets up in the low billions. But we're talking about $1.3 trillion on national defense. People, we're not fighting an army. There are no navies out there. There are no air forces out there that are any challenge to us whatsoever. We are making friends around the world through economics. Yes, there are a few rogue nations that are upset with that. And we'll always have criminals out there trying to act like armies. But we don't need $1.3 trillion in national defense. But $1.3 trillion in space research. Now that would change the game altogether. If we switched that budget, the other nations that consider us even mildly their enemy would ask themselves, what do they know that we don't? Why are they spending $1.3 trillion to return to the moon? Do they realize how much money that is? Do they realize something we don't realize? Is something coming that we can't see? Maybe. Just maybe a leadership like that, a point of focus like that, would change us away from living as nations, banner to banner, creed to creed, religion to religion, and start living as a planet. start living as a race. Because if what many of the churches and organizations are telling us is true, that we are the only humans in the universe, Earth's a pretty fragile basket to keep all the eggs in, don't you think? If we have the capability of exploring, of moving outward, of making it more possible for the human race to survive, don't you think it would be the responsible thing to do instead of spending so much time and so much money innovating new ways to kill people and break things? I think so. We could talk about it. 415-762-1161. Anyone out there listening? 415-762-1161. I'd love to talk about it. I think it's fascinating. We had a lot of smart people out there, Carl Sagan and others, who dreamed about space travel. And you know what? They got to see it in their lifetime. In 1969, Neil Armstrong stepped out of the Eagle onto the moon. 12 other footprints followed those initial footprints. Most of them were Eagle Scouts. That was space travel, people. It ended. It ended in 1972. 1972. Did anybody even know what a cell phone was in 1972? No. Let's talk about it. Scott from Daytona, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. I never had the pleasure of seeing Who Killed the Electric Car. There was a movie presented a while back, I believe. It's been shown on TV. But from what I've gathered, the electric cars that were made around the turn of the century were destroyed. Is there any guarantee that that won't happen again with people coming out with electric cars now? Or is there going to be opposition? What do you think is going to happen when electric cars start being produced in our country?
Yes, I think there'll be a problem like that. I'll tell you the way I think it might happen, because the Department of Motor Vehicles and the NHTSA, that's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is so powerful now. And what they've done is they've set up a precedent with Toyota. You know, Toyota became the number one car producer in America just a couple of years ago. And that was so upsetting to the former number one, General Motors, that with a little bit of lobbying and well-placed golf games, sure enough, Toyota had a quality problem, a sticking electronic throttle. And believe me, Toyota was not the main culprit of this. There were other car companies that had even more people die because of quality problems than Toyota. But Toyota was number one. And so the government got involved and they started recalling cars, millions of them. I can tell you right now, if they can recall millions of Toyotas from happy customers all across the country, they can darn sure go after a few thousand electric cars. No challenge whatsoever.
And I've been in a Dodge Charger where the accelerator has gotten stuck before, and I've been in, I wasn't driving that time, but I was driving when my Delta 88 accelerator got stuck, and that's an engine you don't want to be in the car when the accelerator gets stuck, because it's a very, you know, a cylinder engine there. And so it's that's what I was suspecting, that it was all about getting back at Toyota for producing relatively outstanding vehicles, and then who, after what? After all this Toyota stuff, General Motors offers deals for Toyota drivers, and so General Motors all of a sudden sells more cars as a result of this whole thing happening.
Yeah, and didn't General Motors just recently hang the banners out at all their dealerships that they had repaid their $40 billion with interest 5 years ahead of time?
I've not been by our General Motors. I cannot say, but right now I'm driving a Nissan, but that's only because that's the better of the cars I could have gotten at the time. But I would have bought electric had I been able to afford it and been able to gotten an extension cord to reach from my parking space to my apartment so that I could use the electricity from my apartment. But that's kind of like, that's what I'm up against here.
Last month, the Rasmussen poll released a study that 17% of Americans are now ready to buy an electric car. 17%. That's a huge market. When you're considering 14.5 million new cars selling every year in this country, 17% of that market, I'll take that all day long. Unfortunately, there are no electric cars being produced in America right now, with the exception of the Tesla Roadster, which at $110,000 a copy, I dare say I won't be driving one.
And you have an excellent idea of starting with an electric truck, because, I mean, I see mostly trucks when I'm on the road. I mean, everyone has a truck. It's kind of like the American dream. It's like everyone, you know, it's like, you can have independence with it. You can haul whatever you want. You can move things if you want, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's the greatest thing, but it's also the biggest gas guzzler next to the Wrangler Jeep. But, you know, to start with the truck and have an electric, because that's what America wants. They want the truck. They want that independence. They want, it's kind of like the stagecoach of 21st century. You know, it's like, you know, I can go anywhere in this thing. I can go out to California. I can go out to New York. I can do anything I want and have that freedom that America stands for so much.
Well, I've been driving a truck for the better part of 30 years. I'm on my third truck of my lifetime. I've only owned three vehicles, and I drive them, 300,000 miles. But since I've had an electric truck, I have to tell you, I just don't put diesel in that Dodge very often. Now, when I have to drive more than 100 miles, or I have to haul the trucks to a show or something, of course we fuel it up. But all the little trips to the hardware store, the movies, the mall, everywhere, it's all electric. And, you know, if I could actually drive it legally on the road, that would even be better. Right now I have to drive it and I have to dodge, you know, all the cops because it doesn't have a license plate on it because I can't register it through the DMV. I have an NHTSA permission letter to drive it on the road, but I can't sell them to anybody. So what can I do? We're slowly going through the FMVSS program, crash testing the trucks. It's very expensive. Couple of million dollars later, we're going to get through that process, and then we'll be able to manufacture the vehicles in the U.S. So hopefully we're in the mix, and maybe there'll be 10 or even 20 companies making and selling electric vehicles in the United States.
Last year you were asking for donations. Is there still the need for donations at this time?
Oh, I would say so. I just watched the YouTube last summer of Obama up in Indiana giving away the $382 million in grant funds. It was the only electric vehicle grant in the last 2 years in the United States, and it all went to the major car makers. Not one single electric vehicle company got a dime out of it. That was so frustrating to watch him up there at that microphone telling the people to rousing standing ovations that he was going to put $2 billion into innovative electric cars. It didn't happen. It went to universities, and it went to the major car makers, and not one new job was created.
Mm-hmm. Is there an address that we could send money to?
So, yes, the donations. Well, of course. I mean, I don't want to push my own website, but I can tell you that if you go out there and look for companies like Vision Motor Cars, you can always go to visionmotorcars.com. There's always a way. There are methods of providing money. And some of these companies are public companies. You can go buy stock in their companies and get them up and on their feet. Most of us are privately held at this point because there's no sense in going public unless you've got an event to go public over. Even Tesla hasn't gone public yet. He's still raising private funds. Of course, the $50 million written to him by Mr. Toyota a week and a half ago was definitely a good shot in the arm.
Yes. Well, thanks. I'll get off so other people can call in. Thank you, Dr. Brooks.
I appreciate you so much, Scott. Have a wonderful week down there, and be safe on the Memorial Day.
Thank you.
Good night. All right, so what we're talking about here is the advent of alternative energy. We've talked about biodiesel, cellulosic ethanol, electric cars, wave generators that can sit out in the ocean and take advantage of swells in the water and generate power for coastal cities. We talked about river generators that are not dams. These are turbines that turn underneath the water. They don't interfere with boat traffic. They have to be maintained every now and then because they get something like a tree caught in them. You have to go bring them up, clean them out, put them down. But they generate 4 or 5 megawatts, which is enough to run a small community. And I don't know if you noticed or not, but 80% of the nation's population lives within 20 miles of a coast. It doesn't take rocket science to realize that these tidal generators, wave generators, and river generators can produce a lot of clean, renewable energy, electricity that doesn't cost the community anything. I don't know if you've been out west lately, but all of the reservoirs are full. They're at full pool, which means the water has to go over the dam 24 hours a day, which means they're generating electricity that's so cheap that they're giving it away. 3 cents a mil, and they offered Microsoft almost a year's worth of free electricity to build their data center in Moses Lake, Washington, because the electricity was in surplus. They're making more than we could possibly use because of the hydroelectric power. Now, out here in the Midwest, in Kentucky and Tennessee, we rely on coal to make our energy. That's not very clean. Some of it runs on natural gas, but most of it on coal. The point is that these boilers, these steam turbines, have to be spun up to meet the daytime loads with air conditioning and all kinds of factories and businesses running using electricity. But at nighttime, when things cool off and the lights go down, they can't just stop the turbines and start them up the next day. It takes hours and hours and hours to cool these things off. So they just leave it running. Where does the electricity go? Well, they route it to other grids because we can't use it. So electric vehicles are a use of nighttime energy. Cheap. I mean, you could drive an electric vehicle for about $1 a day. You could go back and forth to work for about $20 to $25 a month. Now, I don't know what you would do with the extra money, but we could spend the rest of the program here making a list if you like. I think everyone out there could use a few extra $1,000 a year. Those of you that get some kind of mileage reimbursement for the miles that you drive, that's all money in your pocket now. You'll still get the mileage reimbursement, but you don't have to buy the gasoline. It just makes sense, people. What you have to do is take control. You cannot wait for the government to feed out 25 cents at a time to these companies, keeping them on the edge of poverty year after year after year. Company after company goes out of business because they can't raise enough money to go into production to deliver these fine designs to you. Fisker, Phoenix, Bright, Vision Motor Cars, Zap, all kinds of electric car companies out here that make great automobiles, but you can't get your hands on them because they can't get the grant funds like General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler, and Nissan, and Toyota. And I can tell you right now, those companies are not going to be producing affordable electric vehicles for you. It isn't going to happen. Forget about it. That Nissan Leaf, that pricing that you see doesn't include the battery, and it doesn't include the charging system. The charging system right now, $90 million. You know who bought it? You did. It will energize one city. One. Which means if you buy a Nissan Leaf in that town, you can't leave town. because there's no place to charge the car up. So let's get practical, people. If you're going to have an affordable electric vehicle, it's going to come from a small company. It's going to come from Bright. It's going to come from Phoenix. It's going to come from Fisker. It's going to come from Vision Motor Cars. It's going to come from a company like that. Look them up. Find out what they need. Call them up and see what you can do to get their vehicles on the road. Talk to your local state legislators. Tell them to relax the DMV requirements on electric vehicles. And let me tell you, there are more regulations, not less, coming down the pike. Now you know what the oil companies have put out there? They have put a lobbyist trying to force the federal government to make electric vehicles make noise. You know why? Because they're saying the blind can't hear electric vehicles coming. Get serious, people. Cars have been quiet for a long, long time. They've been quiet for 40 years. What makes the noise on a car is the tires on the ground, the air going over the car. It's not the exhaust sound. You don't hear that from the front of the car. And a lot of cars are so quiet now, they don't make an exhaust sound. They don't have fans that turn unless the air conditioning is on. They're electric. Get serious. These regulations are nothing more than an effort to keep electric vehicles off the highway. And who controls that? You control that. Call your insurance companies. Call your Department of Motor Vehicles. And write letters to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Tell them to resist these lobbyists trying to keep electric vehicles off the road. You're ready for yours now, aren't you? There are other alternative methods out there. Now they're looking at mid-size and small wind generators. Excuse me. It isn't practical for a single household to buy a wind generator. Who can afford $18,000 for a wind generator for a single house? You just can't afford it. You can't afford solar cells to provide the electricity for a household. It's just not possible. It's not feasible. Who wants to buy 5 or 6 years of electric power in advance? Sure, it pays itself off after 5 years. But are you going to live in that house for 5 years? Not many people do. Most people move between 5 and 8 years, and they're not going to invest $15,000 to $20,000 in alternative energy for a house. But a car they would do. Some of these mid-sized generators, though, are small enough that they could run a single community, like a subdivision. Most of the wind generators that are out on the market now are at least 1 megawatt, 1 to 2 megawatts. And it's not practical to put just one of them up. You have to put 10 or 15 of them up in order to make revenue off of the power, because you're going to be selling it to the grid. But if you're going off grid, if you're not going to connect to the power lines, and you're going off grid, and you're not worried about selling the excess power back to the power companies, which I can tell you takes an act of Congress, then you can buy one of these mid-sized generators. Now, this gets kind of affordable. When you're talking about 100 or 200 homes in a subdivision, street lights, air conditioning, electric stoves, water pumps, all that kind of stuff, one of these mid-sized generators would be just about right. This is a generator that could run a small community, and if you buy two of them where you have a backup, and you have some kind of storage device for times when you don't have much wind. After all, who wants to build their subdivision in an area that's windy all the time? You can run the lines to the subdivision and distribute it, but it's going to take a sizable development and investment. However, the fact that your light bill is local to your own co-op, you might be talking about 1 or even 2 cents a mil. That's pretty inexpensive. And the nice thing about it is, it can't ever be cut off. Your power is there all the time. If the major systems go down because a nuclear power plant goes offline or a dam goes offline, or a coal-fired plant has a problem, your electricity never ends. That might be something the communities could do. Now, here's the good part. That community can be built off-grid, which means you don't have to build along the accepted power lines. You can go out into the more rural areas or undeveloped areas and build these small communities. And if you do it right, with the right kind of roads, where you have a bicycle lane on the side of the road, and you have some electric mass transportation in the community, and possibly places to work, and surrounded by areas of agriculture so you could supply most of your own food and water, now you're talking. Now you're talking green communities that can support themselves largely without any outside influence. They're not required to have daily trucks come in and fill up the local grocery store. It's filled up with a local farmer's market and a local rancher and a local animal farmer. I forgot what they're called. That's okay. It's been a three-hour program. Give me a break. So this takes a little bit longer range thinking, but that kind of energy devices are out there. We also have the river generators. There are several companies that make these generators. They turn very slow speed, high torque. They turn a generator, and they could generate up to 1 megawatt apiece. That's pretty nice. Some of them can be used to make bridges across the river. They actually form a bridge. You build the generators off-site. You bring them to the river, drop them to the bottom, link them together, place your road on top, and you've got yourself a hydroelectric dam without causing any flooding. Nice idea. They also have these generators that work off the seafloor and take advantage of the tides. Now, this won't work in the southern latitudes close to the equator because the tides aren't that much. But you get up toward Massachusetts, along the coast of Newfoundland, Alaska, places like that, where you have a 20 or 30 foot tide, now you've got a sizable amount of moving water, and you can generate and store electricity. So we've talked about wind generators, we've talked about tidal generators, we've talked about the wave motion generators that work off floating devices that go up and down with the undulating water and generate electricity for coastal cities. We've talked about electric cars. And we've also talked about what you can do to make that a reality. We've talked about preparedness. I highly recommend, while you're working that overtime this summer, take one of those checks. Go to 1-800-PREPARE.com and get some supplies in your house. Start with something basic. You don't need to spend any more than $50 or $60 to get a start. This is the kind of stuff you're not going to find at Walmart. You can find it because these are specialized, well-packaged, long-term storage devices and items that will protect your family and your friends and yourself from being a burden on your local emergency staff, your EMT, your fire departments, and your FEMA. You can take care of yourself by doing this in advance. Those people that live along the Gulf or 50 to 100 miles in from the Gulf, be prepared. You may have 14 to 23 major storms this summer. How do they know that? They're already looking out in South Africa where these storms begin to develop and come toward us. They already know that the precursors to these storms are setting up. This could be the worst storm season since 2005. I would listen to the experts, and I would simply make a small effort and get prepared. Now, in the coming weeks, the month of June, here at X Squared Radio, we're going to have some more interviews. We're talking to the author of Universe Solved. We're also talking to Dr. Ed Close. He was on November of last year. We talked about transcendental physics. He has a new book coming out. It's not ready yet. He's got a white paper out. Very interesting stuff we're going to be covering. And we have about 17 minutes left in the program. If maybe less than that, maybe about 12 minutes left in the program. If you want to be part of the program tonight, 415-762-1161. If you have an opinion about the Gulf oil spill from BP, if you have any innovative devices out there that you would like to see get a little airtime and talk about, you can come on the program tonight and talk about it. If you want to talk about the upcoming elections, we don't talk about politics too much here, but we do talk about issues. And if you want to talk about some upcoming issues that have to do with energy or preparedness or space travel or defense, I'd be more than happy to talk about those here on X Squared Radio. We are making some progress in our private company, and we're getting ready to get this electric car business up and running. I appreciate your patience with it, sticking with us and watching for it and visiting the website. Thousands of you have written in and said you'd like to buy one of the cars or one of the trucks. That's certainly helpful. Keep spreading the word. Make sure to keep talking to your congressman there in Kentucky or in North Carolina, where our two locations are. Let's keep talking to them. Keep it in the buzz. Remember, 17% of you said you wanted to buy an electric vehicle. Well, get ready, because they're going to be affordable. They're going to be useful. They're not golf carts with doors now. These are vehicles that accelerate. That little silver sports car you see on the website in the gasoline version goes 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds. Is that quick enough for you? The electric version should be just as spunky. So keep your eye out for those. Keep visiting the website. Keep coming back to X Squared Radio. And remember, we're a proud member of the BBS Radio Network, the most listened to Internet Talk Radio Network in North America. Also, remember that we are making a run for syndication here at X Squared Radio. So please click on the link, webtalkradio.net, webtalkradio.net, and go to the Science and Paranormal section, look up X Squared Radio. We have 30-minute versions of X Squared Radio there. Some have interviews, some are just issues that we like to talk about here on this program. It's a short listen, 30 minutes. The more you click on it, the more you send your friends to it, the better our chances at syndication, which means we get to play on the airwaves. We get to be part of the AM broadcast media. And it's about time that some late-night paranormal talk radio got out there and competed with the 800-pound gorilla. We approach it from a different angle. We like to talk about things at a much more informed, more scientific level. We think, based on our 5 years here at X Squared Radio, that you like it too. We appreciate you being part of the program tonight. Again, our call-in number, 415-762-1161, if you'd like to be part of the program. I know it's Memorial Day weekend, a lot going on out there. I want you to make sure that you keep yourself safe. Have a wonderful Memorial Day off. If you're not working, if you are working, make sure you get that time and a half in there. We appreciate you being part of the program. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.